Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up later this hour, I'll talk with David Peterson. He is the linguist who developed the Dothraki and Valyrian languages for HBO's Game of Thrones. But first, Mark Montgomery and Irene Tinker Powell are both economics professors at Grinnell College. They're also the parents of three children, and the experience of adopting their third child from Sierra Leone has caused them to do a great deal of thinking and research about international adoption. They've just published the book Saving International Adoption, An Argument from Economics and Personal Experience. They'll be reading from their book this afternoon at 4:15 at the Faulkner Gallery in Grinnell as part of the Writers at Grinnell series, and they are here with me now. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And hello, Tinker.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here. And you are both concerned that international adoption is collapsing right now. You point to a number of statistics that back that argument up. I'd love for you to paint the picture for us of what's happening right now. And Tinker, I'll let you start.
Well, the international adoption had been increasing quite substantially up till about 2005. At which point the overall peak was hit at 50,000 worldwide. And since that time, it has fallen by 70%. In the U.S., just international adoption to the U.S., the peak was 23,000, and currently it's about 5,300. That was last year.
All right. So it's fallen precipitously. Mark, why is this happening?
Well, the ostensible reason, the reason that every country will give you, is that they're trying to protect their children, that this is in the best interest of the child. If you look a little more deeply, you start beginning to question that. For example, back in 1988, South Korea put a moratorium on adoption during the Olympic Games in Seoul, because for no other reason that Bryant Gumbel had made the point on air that its major export, South Korea's major export, was its children. There was national embarrassment over that, and for a significant time, they put a moratorium on adoption. Or Russia, for example, which put a moratorium on adoptions only to America in 2012. That really was a response to the Obama administration imposing some sanctions on Russian citizens who had been involved in the death of a whistleblower in custody. And Congress made a rule that it imposed these sanctions, and within 2 weeks, the Duma had passed a law that said no more adoption. So you see that adoption often becomes a kind of political football. Even though the ostensible reason is always protecting children, there usually seems to be some other agenda at work.
So where are children still being adopted from today? I realize the numbers have dropped precipitously. What countries are parents in the United States going to right now to adopt children? Tinker?
Well, primarily there are Eastern European and former Soviet republics. Ukraine is a significant source. Uganda is still placing from Africa. There are several countries that still place for adoption, but at much lower numbers than they did before. And South Korea still places, but again, at much lower numbers. In general, there just aren't as many kids being placed.
Now, the two of you have variety of experiences in becoming parents. You have a birth child. You adopted one son domestically within the United States from Texas, and you adopted another son from Sierra Leone. And I want to start with your first adoption experience when you adopted your son from Texas. Tell me what kind of process you went through. How did you approach that adoption?
Well, we went through an agency. We had considered many options. We had considered foster care. We had considered adoption from abroad, internationally. And what we were told is that African-American and biracial infants had at that time a hard time getting placements in America. We were attracted to the idea of having an infant. We already had a six-year-old, and we were concerned about the process of raising the child, and so we decided to go through an agency to get a black or biracial infant. We got one very quickly because they were hard to place, so it was there was no waiting period whatsoever, and we got Kurt, and that was our first adoption.
In fact, it's still hard to place black and biracial young children and infants in the U.S. There's international adoption from the U.S. to Western European countries of just that kind of child.
So when you went through that process, you went through an agency. Did you have an interaction with Kurt's birth mother?
No, we did not. That was not what today we would call an open adoption. And in fact, the rules in Texas were pretty singularly unsentimental. When the mother decided to give up the child, she had a very short time to change her mind. She had a very short conversation with a social worker, and then the records were sealed. So Kurt's records are really unavailable to us.
Now, a few years later, when you decided to adopt again, why not just follow the same path? What made you want to try international adoption this time?
Well, I think having adopted an infant the first time and having it go very smoothly, we thought that we could handle a little bit more. And we knew because of the AIDS epidemic that there were many children needing families from Africa. Kurt had said he wanted a little brown brother, so we thought Africa would be a good place to look. And we thought, ready to handle a child that was a little older as opposed to an infant.
All right, and a child that was a little bit older would also have probably a different set of needs. I mean, tell me a little bit about what had been going on in Sierra Leone, which is where your son came from, and there were many children living in very difficult conditions there.
Right. Sierra Leone was still, in fact, going through a brutal civil war that was started by the Revolutionary United Front, which was really after diamonds from the country, helped by Charles Taylor from Liberia. And it eventually devolved into a war between several factions in the country. But there were really horrible brutalities. Children were, you know, part of the war. And so it was a terrible background. It ended soon after we started, but that was the background at that point. The life expectancy was 27 years at that point.
So what kind of process did you go through then to adopt a child from Sierra Leone? This was a much longer and more arduous process than your domestic adoption experience.
That's right. We did what modern people do. We literally went online and started looking for countries in Africa that would be placing children, because that's where we thought the need was. And we found very few. I think at that time there might have been three countries that were releasing children. And we found an organization that was in Sierra Leone. We knew Sierra Leone had just emerged from a terrible civil war. There were many homeless children. There were a lot of people who had been handicapped by the brutality of the RUF. And we approached this organization and said, we're interested in adopting, and it took a good year or more to get Jabrilla to come to us, and the process was a little bumpy and a little scary because there were at any given time we thought it might fall through, but we got very lucky, and he came to us in 2002 after about a year of work on that process.
Some of which was just waiting while there was a moratorium on adoptions.
And during that time, had you met him before he came to the United States?
No, we had a picture of him. That was about all. And we had not been to Sierra Leone. Sierra Leone had a residency requirement for adoption, but the organization that we went through had a special dispensation on that. And so we met Jabrila at, actually Tinker met Jabrila at Kennedy International Airport for the first time. He became our son shortly thereafter.
What was that first meeting like, Tinker?
Well, it's hard to describe an emotional occasion like that. I took our older son with us, and that was a great idea. We also had a soccer ball with us, and Jabrila fell into my arms. He was a very small 6-year-old, and hugged me, and then he hugged Kurt, our older son, and they started playing soccer there in the airport. So it was a very joyful time, and he has a very great sense of humor. So we were soon, you know, playing tricks on each other.
Were you able to communicate?
He had very simple English. The lingua franca in Sierra Leone is Creole, so it has some English words in it.
So a little bit.
A little bit,
not a great deal.
And right.
Being 6 years old, what did you know about what had happened to his family, why he was available for adoption?
Well, the story we were told, and it would prove later to be untrue, was that he and his family had been fleeing from McKennytown, which is one of the cities, to Freetown, which is the capital, that they had encountered rebels along the way, and that Jabrila's parents had been murdered, and that he was taken in by an aunt.
So what we found out in the process of writing this book was that the aunt was really his birth mother. And this is often true in international adoption stories. You find out that the story that you were told is not necessarily precisely true. So we, by talking to other birth families, it's often the case that that rumors spread so that they think it will be easier to place their children for adoption
if there's a certain story.
Right. Birth mother has been declared dead, for example.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Mark Montgomery and Irene Tinker Powell, authors of a new book about international adoption. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm talking with Mark Montgomery and Irene Tinker Powell. They are both economics professors at Grinnell College. They are also the parents of 3 children, 1 child by birth, 2 children through adoption. One was a domestic adoption. The other was an international adoption. And they've drawn on that experience, their economic experience, and also a great deal of research to write the new book, Saving International Adoption, An Argument from Economics and Personal Experience. They'll be reading from their book this afternoon at 4:15 at the Faulkner Gallery in Grinnell as part of the Writers at Grinnell series. And just before the break, we were talking about when you adopted your son, Jabrila, from Sierra Leone, that you were told a story about his family. You later learned that that story was not true. In your book, you don't just write about your family and your own personal experiences, but you also tell the story of another girl who came from Sierra Leone, who was adopted into the United States. And I would love for you to tell me a little bit about her and what we can learn from her story. And I know that there are many, many different facets to this story, but if you could give me a kind of a summary. Is it Isada? How do you say her name?
Well, her birth family says Isada.
Isada, okay.
Her adoptive family says Isada, which is what we tend to say.
All right. Well, tell me about her journey.
She was 5 in 1999, when rebels came through the capital, Freetown, where her family, which was a middle-class family, lived. and they fled. And we tell of the events that led up to them deciding that they would place her in an orphanage and eventually allow her to be adopted to the U.S., in which she was lost when rebels were coming through and they couldn't find her for 15 minutes and they were afraid they had lost her. So they, as they said, told us when we interviewed them, they wanted her to be safe and to get a good education in the U.S. So time passes, and eventually, when she's 18, on Facebook, she finds her birth family, or they find her on Facebook. So she has since reunited with them in Sierra Leone. So it's an amazing story. She has a similar story in that her adoptive family was told that her birth parents had died and that an aunt and uncle had placed her for adoption. But again, the same story with Jabrilla is true, that it was her birth parents placed her for adoption.
But she was old enough to know that that wasn't the case. So that was difficult for her, right, to have this story told to her that she knew wasn't true.
Yeah. Absolutely. One of the first things she said in English when she learned it was she pointed to the adoption papers where her name had been written, and she said to her adoptive mother, "That not my name." And she did not understand why had she been placed for adoption. She had parents. Well, the adoptive family had been told that they had been killed, that the people were an aunt and uncle, that this poor child had rearranged her own memories to cover the trauma of losing her parents. And Isada knew that wasn't true. The sad irony of it is at some point, she says, I began to believe it myself. It was only when her family found her on Facebook that she knew the truth about it. And the story illustrates how much deception and misinformation there is often in these adoption stories internationally.
Well, and I can imagine people hearing you talk about this and think, well, that is a great argument against international adoption. And heaven knows, in the news over the years, we have heard some really, truly horrible stories about people having their babies bought by adoption brokers and then adopted by U.S. families that had no idea that the babies had been purchased. You know, there are lots of these things that happen that can go so very wrong with international adoption. So I can see that as an argument against doing it at all. And that's one of the arguments that a lot of these countries have given, that, you know what, we can't make this work. We're not going to do it. We need to protect our children. You go the other direction. Why do you think that this is an indication that we need more international adoption and we need to do it differently?
Well, it is the case that these things happen. And the people who oppose international adoption call all of it child trafficking for the purposes of adoption, but child trafficking in short form, which we insist it's not, because child trafficking you think of as exploiting the child, and the child is not exploited in these cases. But there's definitely fraud in some cases and deception. It's relatively rare that major harm in terms of to the birth families is done of the type that you described. Mm-hmm. It is the case sometimes that, more frequently, that birth parents will receive payment for their child. Now, this has gone on for a long time, and I think we've heard of cases where fathers or parents will sell their child into prostitution in certain countries. So selling them into adoption is a relatively happier outcome for them. But this is not why we argue the way we argue. We argue what we do because the biggest problem for the adoptions the way they are now and the way that international organizations are forcing them to be even more, is that there's no communication between the birth parents and the adoptive parents. And if that communication could occur, the deception of the birth parents would not be able to occur as well. And we talk a lot about the private adoption system in the U.S. and the open adoption movement as being similar to what we would want to have happen in the international system.
I can imagine many obstacles to that. I mean, a lack of access to technology is one, language barriers is another. Lack of education in some cases could also be a tremendous barrier. How do you see that working?
Well, it is often said that, look, if you allow rich foreigners to come in and swoop down and take people's children and deceive them and that it all becomes about money, these people are going to be exploited. We argue pretty much just the opposite. Remember, we're economists, okay? We have some weird views of the world. We have some weird views of markets, okay? And we say that actually what the current system does, by not allowing the adoptive parents and the birth parents to meet, disempowers the birth parents. That when you look at the American system, which is quite different, you have mothers having a lot of control over what happens to their children. And that's basically what we're advocating at the international level.
And they tend to be lower income, less educated women who are placing their children in the U.S. as well. And the same argument would have been made before instituting this system if it were being instituted today.
Well, and let's talk just personal economics. With your experience with domestic adoption and your experience with international adoption, how much did the process cost you? And again, I mean, I think that we have a really hard time talking about money when it comes to adoption, but for many families, that's a huge barrier to adoption, is the incredible cost. So what was the comparison?
Well, it was 10 years difference in time. So it's hard for us to compare. And we haven't done the calculation that we should as economists and compare the inflation-adjusted price. But the prices internationally right now are very, very high, higher than the prices domestically, unless you do this private route. And we should say that there are still a lot of constraints on the private adoption market for white infants, because it's not legal to pay someone for their child. You can pay expenses, and the ability to do that varies a lot from state to state. But the cost for international adoptions are very high. But who does that money go to? It goes to facilitators. It goes to lawyers in the sending countries. It goes to hotels, airlines, you know, even bellhops. But it doesn't go to the people who are making the largest sacrifice, the birth families. And it doesn't help them with the problems in their family, like education and health.
So lay out your proposal for me. What are you proposing?
Well, we are simply saying, look, if this were possible, now bear in mind, much of this is in the hands of people who are in third world countries or fourth or any countries, and we don't have control over their policy. But if it were up to us, we would open up the process and allow more negotiation between the parents of the child and the adoptive parents who want to take the child with them to their new country. And we recognize that this negotiation might involve some compensation to the poor families. And this is utter anathema to anybody discussing international adoption. It's a horrible idea, and everybody thinks it's terrible. We're saying that maybe that's something we need to tolerate if we're going to improve the system. The system is collapsing. The so-called scandals are causing the thousands and thousands of children who could be served by getting a family to be shut off in orphanages or in desperate situations in third world countries.
We think that in most cases there would be an agreement about keeping some communication. All the birth families that we talked to wanted to have their children placed, even the ones that were not particularly happy with the situation, did not want to bring their children back from the U.S. They wanted to be able to know if their children were okay and be able to, you know whether the child was perhaps going to visit when they were 18 or older than that. So that would probably be part of any agreement. And then compensation probably would be part of most of the agreements. The one of the key factors is that if there were problems with these agreements down the road, the receiving country, the relatively high-income countries, would need to their legal systems would need to enforce any agreements that had occurred.
So, okay, tell me a little bit more about your vision of oversight if this kind of process were allowed. Who would make sure that there wasn't abuse?
Well, what kind of abuse are we talking about? Are we talking about abuse of the children? Well, the process of adopting requires that the adoptive parents be vetted in extraordinary ways that no birth family ever has to face. So what we would very strongly maintain is that you've got to make sure that these children are coming to the families who would take care of them. And that process has been taken care of. The vetting of children coming into American families, European families, is really quite extraordinary. You have to verify that the notary republic who authorized a document that said you have no police report is in fact a notary republic. I mean, it's quite extraordinary.
And we wouldn't propose changing that at all.
Not at all. But the idea of oversight, right now, in a sense, there's no oversight because a woman gives up her baby. She's not allowed to negotiate with the adoptive parents, so she gives it up to an intermediary. The intermediary is under very little obligation to take care of her. She does not have any idea what her other options are. The baby leaves. She never sees it. She never has the opportunity to enforce some kind of contract that says, I need to hear about this child. The system now has very little oversight. If there were negotiation and open communication and possibly even legal contracts, that itself would be a system that is much more self-enforcing than this secretive system that we have now. That's what we argue.
Now, I want to return to something that you were talking about earlier, and that is the fact that there are many children in the United States who are in need of adoptive families, many infants, but also many young children, whether that's through the foster care system or not. Why focus on international adoption when there are kids in the United States who need homes?
Well, we would suggest that there should be reforms in the U.S. as well. And we certainly encourage anyone who would perhaps want to adopt from the foster care system, where there are children who really need homes, and perhaps black and biracial infants or toddlers to adopt here. Usually, potential adoptive parents have, you know, preferences of where to start with this process. But there are, you know, I don't want to go through them now, and maybe we'll write a book about that in the future, but there are clearly reforms to undertake in the U.S. as well.
Now, in the introduction to your book, you write about how it is completely verboten to mix economics and adoption. In a sense, you're kind of lighting a fuse with this whole idea. Why put it forward? What do you hope to accomplish through publishing this book?
Well, we do not have any illusions about the fact that, we have published this book with this radical argument and it will change the nature of adoption nationally, internationally for all times. We are not as naive as that. But there is, as social scientists, the sense that the alternative view needs to be put forward. It needs to enter the conversation, even if it does no more than anchor the far end of the distribution of opinions. There's value in that. There's value in forcing people to think about this absolute ironclad proscription on compensating anybody, of thinking about money, of pretending, if you will, that money is not an issue, when money is always an issue in these kind of situations. And to sort of pull aside the veil and say, let's stop pretending that none of this has to do with sale, because much of it does. That voice ought to be heard, even if it's a small voice in the wilderness.
Tinker, anything to add?
Well, right now we're trying to impose a Western system on lesser developed countries that was one from 50, 60 years ago that we've abandoned because adult adoptees and birth parents hated it. And so I don't think that's the model that we want to be following.
Well, thank you both for talking with me and for sharing your story today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Mark Montgomery and Irene Tinker Powell, they're both economics professors at Grinnell College and have a great deal of experience with adoption. They've just published the book Saving International Adoption, An Argument from Economics and Personal Experience. They'll be reading from their book this afternoon at 4:15 at the Faulkner Gallery in Grinnell as part of the Writers at Grinnell series. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.